protected students from bullies too. It didn't matter if Harry knew why Severus had told him. It still made him feel warm inside, and proud, and made it impossible to walk away.
Fine, Harry said. Tell me about Lysarth. Why is he being bullied?
Severus's face lost the faint smile.
You think there are reasons, Potter?
Perhaps not,
Harry said quietly.
But the thought had occurred to me that he might have pushed some unimportant mudblood girl down the stairs.
Lysarth Lestrange, Severus said, his voice now cold, is the son of Bellatrix Black, the most fanatic and evil servant of the Dark Lord. Lysarth is the acknowledged bastard of Rabastan Lestrange. Shortly after the Dark Lord's death, Bellatrix and Rabastan, and Rabastan's brother Rodolphus, were captured while torturing Alice and Frank Longbottom. All three are in Azkaban for life. The Longbottoms were driven insane by repeated cruciatus and remain in St. Mungo's incurable ward. Is any of that a good reason to bully him, Potter?
It's no reason at all, Harry said, still quietly. And Lysarth himself has done no wrong that you know.
The faint smile crossed Severus's lips again.
He is no more a saint than anyone else. But he has pushed no mudblood girls down the stairs. Not that I ever heard of.
Or saw in his mind, said Harry.
Severus's expression was chill.
I did not invade his privacy, Potter. I looked within the Gryffindors, rather. He is simply a convenient target for their little satisfactions.
A cold wash of anger ran down Harry's spine, and he had to remind himself that Severus might not be a trustworthy source of information.
"And you think," Harry said, "that an intervention by Harry Potter, the boy who lived, might prove effective?"
"Indeed,"
said Severus Snape, and told Harry when and where the Gryffindors were planning their next little game. There is a main hallway running through the middle of Hogwarts' second floor on the north-south axis, and near the centre of this hallway there is an opening into a short corridor which goes a dozen paces back before turning at a right angle, making an L-shape, and then goes a dozen paces more before it ends at a bright, wide window, looking out from three stories above upon the light drizzle falling over the east grounds of Hogwarts. Standing by the window, you can hear nothing of the main hallway, and no one in the hallway would hear what went on by the window. If you were thinking there is anything odd about this, you haven't been in Hogwarts very long. Four boys in red-trimmed robes are laughing, and a boy in green-trimmed robes is screaming and grabbing frantically onto the edges of the opened window with his hands as the four boys make as though to push him out. It's just a joke, of course, and besides, a fall from that height wouldn't kill a wizard. It's all good fun. If you think there's anything odd about this...
"What are you doing?"
says a sixth boy's voice. The four boys in red-trimmed robes spin around with sudden starts, and the boy in green-trimmed robes frantically pushes himself away from the window and falls to the floor, face streaked with tears.
"Oh,"
says the most handsome of the boys in red-trimmed robes, sounding relieved.
"It's you. Hey, Lessie, you know who this is?"
There isn't any answer from the boy on the floor, who's trying to get his sniffling under control, and the boy in red-trimmed robes draws back his leg for a kick.
"Stop it!"
shouts the sixth boy. The boy in the red-trimmed robes wobbles as he aborts the kick.
He says, "do you know who this is?"
The sixth boy's breathing sounds strange.
"Lasath Lestrange,"
he says, his breath coming in short pants.
"And he didn't do anything to my parents. He was 5 years old."
Neville Longbottom stared at the four huge fifth-year bullies in front of him, trying very hard to control his trembling. He should have just told Harry Potter no.
"Why are you defending him?"
said the handsome one slowly, sounding puzzled with the first hints of offence.
"He's a Slytherin, and a Lestrange."
"He's a boy who lost his parents,"
said Neville Longbottom.
I know how that is."
He didn't know where the word had come from.
It sounded too cool, like something Harry Potter would say.
The trembling went on, though.
"Who do you think you are?"
said the handsome one, starting to sound angry.
"I am Neville, the last scion of the noble and most ancient house of Longbottom."
Neville couldn't say it.
"I think he's a traitor,"
said one of the other Gryffindors, and there was a sudden sinking sensation in Neville's stomach. He'd known it.
He'd just known it.
Harry Potter had been wrong after all. Bullies wouldn't stop only because Neville Longbottom told them to stop. The handsome one took a step forward, and the three others followed.
"So, that's how it is for you,"
Neville said, amazed at how steady his voice was.
"It doesn't matter to you if it's Lasath Lestrange or Neville Longbottom."
Lasath Lestrange let out a sudden gasp from where he was lying on the floor.
"Evil is evil,"
snarled the same boy who'd spoken before.
"And if you're friends with evil, you're evil too."
The four took another step forward. Lasath rose, wobbling to his feet. His face was grey, and he took a few steps forward and leaned against the wall, and didn't say anything. His eyes were fixed on the turn in the hallway, the way out.
"Friends?"
Neville said. Now his voice was going up a bit in pitch.
"Yes, I have friends. One of them is the boy who lived."
A couple of the Gryffindors looked suddenly worried. The handsome one didn't flinch.
"Harry Potter isn't here," he said, his voice hard. "And if he was, I don't think he'd like to see a Longbottom defending a Lestrange."
And the Gryffindors took another long step forward, and behind them, Lasath crept along the wall, waiting for his chance. Neville swallowed, and raised his right hand, with his thumb and forefinger pressed together. He shut his eyes because Harry Potter had made him promise not to peek. If this didn't work, he was never trusting anyone again. His voice came out surprisingly clear, considering.
"Harry James Potter, Evans Verus. Harry James Potter, Evans Verus. Harry James Potter, Evans Verus. By the debt that you owe me, and the power of your true name, I summon you. I open the way for you. I call upon you to manifest yourself before me."
Neville snapped his fingers. And then Neville opened his eyes. Lysarth Lestrange was staring at him. The four Gryffindors were staring at him. The handsome one started to chuckle, and that set off the other three.
"Was Harry Potter supposed to step around the corner or something?" said the handsome one. "Aww, looks like you've been stood up."
The handsome one took a menacing step forward toward Neville. The other three followed in lockstep.
"Ahem,"
said Harry Potter from behind them, leaning against the wall by the window, in the dead end of the hallway, where nobody could possibly have gotten to without being seen. If watching people scream always felt this good, Neville could sort of understand why people became bullies. Harry Potter stalked forward, placing himself between Lysarth Lestrange and the others. He swept his icy gaze across the boys in red-trimmed robes, and then his eyes came to rest on the handsome one, the ringleader.
"Mr. Carl Sloper," said Harry Potter, "I believe I have comprehended this situation fully. If Lysarth Lestrange has ever committed a single evil himself, rather than being born to the wrong parents, the fact is not known to you. If I am mistaken in this, Mr. Sloper, I suggest you inform me at once."
Neville saw the fear and awe on the other boys' faces. He was feeling it himself. Harry had claimed it would be a trick. But how could it be?
"But he's a Lestrange," said the ringleader.
"He's a boy who lost his parents," Harry Potter said, his voice growing even colder.
This time all three of the other Gryffindors flinched.
"So," said Harry Potter, "you saw that Neville didn't want you tormenting an innocent boy on behalf of the Longbottoms. This failed to move you. If I tell you that the boy who lived also thinks you're in the wrong, that what you did today was a terrible mistake, does that make a difference?"
The ringleader took a step toward Harry. The others did not follow him.
"Carl," one of them said, swallowing, "maybe we should go."
"They said you're going to be the next Dark Lord," the ringleader said, staring at Harry.
A grin crossed Harry Potter's face.
"They also say I'm secretly betrothed to Ginevra Weasley, and there's a prophecy about us conquering France."
The smile faded.
"Since you're determined to force the issue, Mr. Carl Sloper, let me make things clear. Leave Lysarth alone. I will know if you don't."
"So Lessie snarked to you," said the ringleader coldly.
"Sure," said Harry Potter dryly. "And he also told me what you did today after you left charms class, in a private, secluded place where no one could see you, with a certain Hufflepuff girl wearing a white ribbon in her hair."
The ringleader's jaw dropped in shock. Said one of the other Gryffindors in a high-pitched voice, and spun on his heels and ran around the corner. His footsteps rapidly pattered away and faded. And then there were six.
"Ah!"
said Harry Potter.
There goes a slightly intelligent young man. The rest of you could stand to learn from Bertram Kirk's example before you get into, shall we say, trouble.
Are you threatening to snark on us?
Said the handsome Gryffindor, his voice trying to be angry and rather wavering.
Bad things happen to snarkers.
The other two Gryffindors started slowly moving back. Harry Potter started laughing.
Ho, ho, ho! You did not just say that. Are you really trying to intimidate me? Me? Now, honestly, do you think you're scarier than Peregrine Derrick, Severus Snape, or, for that matter, you know who?
Even the ringleader flinched at that. Harry Potter raised his hand, fingers poised, and all three of the Gryffindors leaped backward, and one of them blurted,
"Don't!"
"See?"
said Harry Potter.
"This is where I snap my fingers, and you become part of a hilariously amusing story that will be told with much nervous laughter at dinner tonight. But the thing is, people I trust keep telling me not to do that. Professor McGonagall told me I was taking the easy way out of everything, and Professor Quirrell says I need to learn how to lose. So, you remember that story where I let myself get beaten up by some older Slytherins? We could do that. You could bully me for a while, and I could let you. Only, you remember that part at the end where I tell my many, many friends inside this school not to do anything about it? This time, we'll skip that part. So, go ahead. Bully me."
Harry Potter stepped forward, his arms opened wide in invitation. The three Gryffindors broke and ran, and Neville had to sidestep quickly to avoid getting run over. There was silence as their footsteps faded, and then more silence after that. And then there were three. Harry Potter drew a deep breath, then exhaled.
"Phew,"
he said.
"How are you doing, Neville?"
Neville's voice came out in a high-pitched squeak.
"Okay, that was really cool."
A grin flashed across Harry Potter's face.
"You were pretty cool too, you know."
Neville knew that Harry Potter was just saying that, trying to make him feel good, and it still started a warm glow inside his chest. Harry turned toward Lestrange Lestrange.
"Are you okay, Lestrange?"
said Neville before Harry could open his mouth. Now, there was something you didn't expect to find yourself saying, ever. Lestrange Lestrange turned slowly and stared at Neville, his face tight, no longer crying, tears glistening as they dried.
"You think you know how it is,"
said Lestrange, his voice high and shaking.
"You think you know? My parents are in Azkaban. I try not to think about it, and they always remind me. They think it's great that Mother is there, in the cold and the dark, with the Dementors sucking away her life. I wish I was like Harry Potter. At least his parents aren't hurting. My parents are always hurting, every second of every day. I wish I was like you. At least you can see your parents sometimes. At least you know they loved you. If Mother ever loved me, the Dementors will have eaten that thought by now."
Neville's eyes were wide with shock. He hadn't expected this. Lysarth turned to Harry Potter, whose eyes were full of horror. Lysarth flung himself on the floor in front of Harry Potter, touched his forehead to the ground, and whispered,
"Help me, Lord!"
There was an awful silence. Neville couldn't think of a single thing to say, and from the naked shock on Harry's face, he couldn't think of anything either.
"They say you can do anything. Please, please, my lord, get my parents out of Azkaban. I'll be your loyal servant forever. My life will be yours, and my death as well. Only, please, Lysarth,"
Harry said, his voice breaking.
"Lysarth, I can't. I can't really do things like that. It's all just stupid tricks." "It's not," said Lysarth, his voice high and desperate. "I saw it. The stories are true. You can..."
Harry swallowed.
"Lysarth, I set the whole thing up with Neville. We planned it all out in advance. Ask him."
They had, though Harry hadn't said how he was going to do any of it. When Lysarth looked up from the floor, his face was ghastly, and his voice came out in a shriek that hurt Neville's ears.
"You son of a mudblood! You could get her out. You just won't. I got down on my knees and begged you, and you still won't help. I should have known. You're the boy who lived. You think she belongs there. I can't,"
Harry said, his voice as desperate as Lysarth's.
"It's not a question of what I want. I don't have the power."
Lysarth rose to his feet and spat on the floor in front of Harry, and then turned and walked away. When he was around the corner, the sound of his feet sped up, and as they faded, Neville thought he heard a single sob. And then there were two. Neville looked at Harry. Harry looked at Neville.
"Wow,"
Neville said quietly.
"He didn't seem very grateful for being rescued. He thought I could help him,"
Harry said, his voice hoarse.
"He had hope for the first time in years."
Neville swallowed and said it.
"I'm sorry. What?"
said Harry, sounding totally confused.
"I wasn't grateful when you helped me. Every single thing you said before was completely right,"
said the boy who lived.
No,
Neville said.
It wasn't.
They simultaneously gave brief, sad smiles, each condescending to the other.
"I know this wasn't real,"
said Neville.
I know I couldn't have done anything if you hadn't been here. But thanks for letting me pretend."
"Give it a break,"
said Harry. Harry had turned from Neville and was staring out the window at the gloomy clouds. A completely ridiculous thought came to Neville.
"Are you feeling guilty because you can't get Lysarth's parents out of Azkaban?"
"No," said Harry. A few seconds went by.
Yes,
said Harry.
"You're silly," said Neville. "I am aware of this,"
said Harry.
Do you have to do literally anything anyone asks you?
The boy who lived turned back and looked at Neville again.
Do? No. Feel guilty about not doing? Yes.
Neville was having trouble finding words.
Once the Dark Lord died, Bellatrix Black was literally the most evil person in the entire world, and that was before she went to Azkaban. She tortured my mother and father into insanity because she wanted to find out what happened to the Dark Lord.
I know, Harry said quietly.
I get that, but... No, you don't. She had a reason for doing that, and my parents were both auras. It's not even close to the worst thing she's ever done.
Neville's voice was shaking.
Even so, said the boy who lived, his eyes distant as they stared off into somewhere else,
some other place that Neville couldn't imagine.
There might be some incredibly clever solution that makes it possible to save everyone and let them all live happily ever after. And if only I was smart enough, I would have thought of it by now.
You have problems, said Neville. You think you ought to be what Lysarth Lestrange thinks you are?
Yeah, said the boy who lived. That pretty much nails it. Every time someone cries out in prayer and I can't answer, I feel guilty about not being God.
Neville didn't quite understand that, but...
That doesn't sound good.
Harry sighed.
I understand that I have a problem, and I know what I need to do to solve it. All right, I'm working on it.
Harry watched Neville leave. Of course, Harry hadn't said what the solution was. The solution, obviously, was to hurry up and become God. Neville's footsteps moved off, and soon could no longer be heard. And then, there was one.
"Hum,"
said Severus Snape's voice from directly behind him. Harry let out a small scream and instantly hated himself. Slowly, Harry turned around. The tall, greasy man in the spotted robes was leaning against the wall in the same position Harry had occupied.
"A fine invisibility cloak, Potter," drawled the potions master. "Much is explained."
"Oh, bloody crap."
"And perhaps I have been in Dumbledore's company too long," said Severus, "but I cannot help but wonder if that is the Cloak of Invisibility."
Harry immediately turned into someone who'd never heard of the Cloak of Invisibility, and who was exactly as smart as Harry thought Severus thought Harry was.
"Oh, possibly," said Harry. "I trust you realize the implications if it is."
Severus's voice was condescending.
"You have no idea what I'm talking about, do you, Potter? A rather clumsy try at fishing."
Professor Quirrell had remarked over their lunch that Harry really needed to conceal his state of mind better than putting on a blank face when someone discussed a dangerous topic, and had explained about one-level deceptions, two-level deceptions, and so on. So, either Severus was, in fact, modelling Harry as a one-level player, which made Severus himself two-level and Harry's three-level move had been successful, or Severus was a four-level player and wanted Harry to think the deception had been successful. Harry, smiling, had asked Professor Quirrell what level he played at, and Professor Quirrell, also smiling, had responded,
"One level higher than you."
So, you were watching this whole time, said Harry. Disillusionment, I think it's called.
A thin smile.
It would have been foolish of me to take the slightest risk that you came to harm.
And you wanted to see the result of your test firsthand, said Harry. So, am I like my father?
A strange, sad expression came over the man, one that looked foreign to his face.
I should sooner say, Harry Potter, that you resemble...
Severus stopped short. He stared at Harry.
Lestrange called you a son of a mudblood, Severus said slowly. It didn't seem to bother you much.
Harry furrowed his eyebrows.
Not under those circumstances, no.
You'd just helped him,
Severus said. His eyes were intent on Harry.
And he threw it back in your face. Surely that isn't something you'd just forgive?
He'd just been through a pretty harrowing experience,
Harry said.
And I don't think being rescued by first years helped his pride much either.
I suppose it was easy enough to forgive,
Severus said, and his voice was odd.
Since Lestrange means nothing to you, just some strange Slytherin. If it was a friend, perhaps you would have felt far more injured by what he said.
If he was a friend, Harry said, all the more reason to forgive him.
There was a long silence. Harry felt, and he couldn't have said why or from where, that the air was filling up with a dreadful tension, like water rising, and rising, and rising. Then Severus smiled, looking suddenly relaxed once more, and all the tension vanished.
You are a very forgiving person, Severus said, still smiling. I suppose your stepfather, Michael Veris Evans, was the one who taught it to you?
More like Dad's science fiction and fantasy collection, said Harry. Sort of my fifth parent, really. I've lived the lives of all the characters in all my books, and all their mighty wisdom thunders in my head. Somewhere in there was someone like Lysarth, I expect, though I couldn't say who. It wasn't hard to put myself in his shoes, and it was my books that told me what to do about it, too. The good guys forgive.
Severus gave a light, amused laugh.
I'm afraid I wouldn't know much about what good people do.
Harry looked at him. That was kind of sad, actually.
I'll send you some novels with good people in them, if you like.
I should like to ask your advice about something,
Severus said, his voice casual.
I know of another fifth-year Slytherin who was being bullied by Gryffindors. He was wooing a beautiful muggle-born girl who came across him being bullied and tried to rescue him. And he called her a mudblood, and that was the end for them. He apologized many times, but she never forgave him. Have you any thoughts for what he could have said or done to win from her the forgiveness you gave Lestrange?
Harry said. Based on only that information, I'm not sure he was the main one who had a problem. I'd have told him not to date someone that incapable of forgiveness. Suppose they'd gotten married. Can you imagine life in that household?
There was a pause.
Oh, but she could forgive, Severus said with amusement in his voice. Why, afterward, she went off and became the girlfriend of the bully. Tell me, why would she forgive the bully, and not the bullied?
Harry shrugged.
I had a wild guess. Because the bully had hurt someone else very badly, and the bullied had hurt her just a little, and to her that just felt far more unforgivable, somehow. Or, not to put too fine a point on it, was the bully handsome, or, for that matter, rich?
There was another pause.
Yes, to both, said Severus.
And there you have it, said Harry. Not that I've ever been through high school myself, but my books give me to understand that there's a certain kind of teenage girl who'll be outraged by a single insult if the boy's plain or poor, yet who can somehow find room in her heart to forgive a rich and handsome boy his bullying. She was shallow, in other words. Tell whoever it was that she wasn't worthy of him, and he needs to get over it and move on and... next time, date girls who are deep instead of pretty.
Severus stared at Harry in silence, his eyes glittering. The smile had faded, and though Severus's face twitched, it did not return. Harry was starting to feel a bit nervous.
Not that I've got any experience in the area myself, obviously, but I think that's what a wise advisor from my books would say.
There was more silence, and more glittering. It was probably a good time to change the subject.
So,
Harry said,
did I pass your test, whatever it was?
I think, Severus said, that there should be no more conversations between us, Potter, and you would be exceedingly wise never to speak of this one.
Harry blinked.
Would you mind telling me what I did wrong?
You offended me, said Severus, and I no longer trust your cunning.
Harry stared at Severus, taken rather aback.
But you have given me well-meant advice, said Severus Snape, and so I will give your true advice in return.
His voice was almost perfectly steady, like a string stretched almost perfectly horizontal, despite the massive weight hanging from its middle, by a million tons of tension pulling at either end.
You almost died today, Potter. In the future, never share your wisdom with anyone unless you know exactly what you are both talking about.
Harry's mind finally made the connection.
You were that...
Harry's mouth snapped shut as the almost died part sank in 2 seconds too late.
"Yes," said Severus, "I was."
And the terrible tension flooded back into the room like water pressurized at the bottom of the ocean. Harry couldn't breathe.
"Lose now!" "I didn't know,"
Harry whispered.
"No,"
said Severus. Just that one word. Harry stood there in silence, his mind frantically searching for options. Severus stood between him and the window, which was a real pity, because a fall from that height wouldn't kill a wizard.
"Your books betrayed you, Potter,"
said Severus, still in that voice stretched tight by a million tons of pull.
"They did not tell you the one thing you needed to know. You cannot learn from stories what it is like to lose the one you love. That is something you could never understand without feeling it yourself."
"My father,"
Harry whispered. It was his best guess, the one thing that might save him.
"My father tried to protect you from the bullies."
A ghastly smile stretched across Severus's face, and the man moved toward Harry. And past him.
"Goodbye, Potter,"
said Severus, not looking back on his way out.
"We shall have little to say to each other from today on."
And at the corner, the man stopped, and without turning, spoke one final time.
"Your father was the bully,"
said Severus Snape.
"And what your mother saw in him was something I never did understand until this day."
He left. Harry turned and walked toward the window. His shaking hands went on to the ledge.
"Never give anyone wise advice unless you know exactly what you're both talking about. Got it?"
Harry stared out at the clouds and the light drizzle for a while. The window looked out on the east grounds, and it was afternoon, so if the sun was visible through the clouds at all, Harry couldn't see it. His hands had stopped shaking, but there was a tight feeling in Harry's chest, like it was being compressed by metal bands. So, his father had been a bully, and his mother had been shallow. Maybe they'd grown up later. Good people like Professor McGonagall did seem to think the world of them, and it might not be only because they were heroic martyrs. Of course, that was scant consolation when you were 11 and about to turn into a teenager, and wondering what sort of teenager you might become. So very terrible. So very sad. Such an awful life Harry led. Learning that his genetic parents hadn't been perfect, why, he ought to spend a while moping about that, feeling sorry for himself. Maybe he could complain to Lysarth Lestrange. Harry had read about Dementors. Cold and darkness surrounded them. And fear. They sucked away all your happy thoughts, and in that absence all your worst memories rose to the surface. He could imagine himself in Lysarth's shoes, knowing that his parents were in Azkaban for life, that place from which no one had ever escaped. And Lysarth would be imagining himself in his mother's place, in the cold, and the darkness, and the fear, alone with all of her worst memories. Even in her dreams, every second of every day. For an instant, Harry imagined his own mum and dad in Azkaban, with the Dementors sucking out their life, draining away the happy memories of their love for him. Just for an instant, before his imagination blew a fuse and called an emergency shutdown and told him never to imagine that again. Was it right to do that to anyone? Even the second most evil person in the world? No, said the wisdom of Harry's books. Not if there was any other way. Any other way at all. And unless the wizarding justice system was as perfect as their prisons, and that sounded rather improbable, all things considered, somewhere in Azkaban was a person who was entirely innocent. And probably more than one. There was a burning sensation in Harry's throat, and moisture was gathering in his eyes, and he wanted to teleport all of Azkaban's prisoners to safety and call down fire from the sky and blast that terrible place down to bedrock. But he couldn't, because he wasn't God. And Harry remembered what Professor Quirrell had said beneath the starlight.
Sometimes, when this flawed world seems unusually hateful, I wonder whether there might be some other place, far away, where I should have been. But the stars are so very, very far away. And I wonder what I would dream about if I slept for a long, long time.
Right now, this flawed world seemed unusually hateful. And Harry couldn't understand Professor Quirrell's words. It might have been an alien that had spoken, or an artificial intelligence, something built along such different lines from Harry that his brain couldn't be forced to operate in that mode. You couldn't leave your home planet while it still contained a place like Azkaban. You had to stay and fight.
Hello, you awesome listeners. So, looking at the stats of this podcast, more than a quarter of you are listening on Audible. Currently, this audiobook is ranked 5th on all of audible.com for fiction podcasts. Pretty cool. And I've realised that the ranking is based on the number of reviews that you have. So, if we get a bunch more reviews, we can jump right up there to the top. Let me just check. Ah yes, so we currently have 70 reviews. The top one has 168. We only need 100 more reviews on Audible to be the top fiction podcast on all of Audible. I think that's possible. We're getting between 500 and 1,000 downloads a day, so there's a lot of you out there. If you are on the Audible app and listening to this podcast, please review the overall podcast. You can review each chapter individually, but I think it's the overall rating that changes the rankings. You heroes!
Chapter 28. Reductionism.
Okay, Harry said, swallowing. Okay, Hermione, it's enough. You can stop.
The white sugar pearl in front of Hermione still hadn't changed shape or colour at all, even though she was concentrating harder than Harry had ever seen, her eyes squeezed shut, beads of sweat on her forehead, and trembling as it gripped the wand.
Hermione, stop! It's not going to work, Hermione. I don't think we can make things that don't exist yet.
Slowly, Hermione's hand relaxed its grasp on the wand.
I felt it,
she said in a bare whisper.
I thought I felt it start to transfigure. Just for a second.
There was a lump in Harry's throat.
You are probably imagining it. Hoping too hard.
I probably was, she said.
She looked like she wanted to cry. Slowly, Harry took his mechanical pencil in his hand and reached over to the sheet of paper with all the items crossed out, and drew a line through the item that said, Alzheimer's cure. They couldn't have fed anyone a transfigured pill, but transfiguration, at least the kind they could do, didn't enchant the targets. It wouldn't transfigure a regular broomstick into a flying one. So, if Hermione had been able to make a pill at all, it would have been a non-magical pill, one that worked for ordinary material reasons. They could have secretly made pills for a Muggle science lab, let them study the pills and try to reverse-engineer them before the transfiguration wore off. No one in either world would need to know that magic had been involved. It would just be another scientific breakthrough. It hadn't been the sort of thing a wizard would think of, either. They didn't respect mere patterns of atoms that much. They didn't think of enchanted material things as objects of power. If it wasn't magical, it wasn't interesting. Earlier, Harry had very secretly, he hadn't even told Hermione, tried to transfigure nanotechnology, a la Eric Drexler. He'd tried to produce a desktop nanofactory, of course, not tiny self-replicating assemblers. Harry wasn't insane. It would have been godhood in a single shot if it had worked.
That was it for today, right?
Said Hermione. She was slumped back in her chair, leaning her head against the back, and her face showed her tiredness, which was very unusual for Hermione. She liked to pretend she was limitless, at least when Harry was around.
One more, Harry said cautiously. But that one's small. Plus, it might actually work. I've saved it for last because I was hoping we could end on an up note. It's real stuff, not like phases. They've already made it in the laboratory, not like the Alzheimer's cure. And it's a generic substance, not specific like the lost books you tried to transfigure copies of. I made a diagram of the molecular structure to show you. We just want to make it longer than it's ever been made before, and with all the tubes aligned, and the endpoint embedded in diamond.
Harry produced a sheet of graph paper. Hermione sat back up, took it, and studied it, frowning.
These are all carbon atoms? And, Harry, what's the name? I can't transfigure it if I don't know what it's called.
Harry made a disgusted face. He was still having trouble getting used to that sort of thing. It shouldn't matter what something was named if you knew what it was.
They're called Bucky tubes, or carbon nanotubes. It's a kind of fullerene that was discovered just this year. It's about 100 times stronger than steel and a sixth of the weight.
Hermione looked up from the graph paper, her face surprised.
That's real?
Yeah, Harry said. Just hard to make the Muggle way. If we could get enough of the stuff, we could use it to build a space elevator all the way up to geosynchronous orbit or higher. And in terms of Delta V, that's halfway to anywhere in the solar system. Plus, we could throw out solar-powered satellites like confetti.
Hermione was frowning again.
Is this stuff safe?
I don't see why it wouldn't be, Harry said. A Bucky tube is just a graphite sheet wrapped into a circular tube, basically, and graphite is the same stuff used in pencils.
I know what graphite is, Harry,
Hermione said. She brushed her hair back absent-mindedly, her eyebrows furrowed as she stared at the sheet of paper. Harry reached into a pocket of his robes and produced a white thread tied to two small grey plastic rings at either end. He'd added drops of superglue where the thread met either ring, to make it all a single object that could be transfigured as a whole. Cyanoacrylate, if Harry remembered correctly, worked by covalent bonds, and that was as close to being a solid object as you ever got in a world ultimately composed of tiny individual atoms.
"When you're ready," Harry said. "Try to transfigure this into a set of aligned bucky tube fibers embedded in two solid diamond rings."
"All right,"
Hermione said slowly.
"Harry, I feel like I just missed something."
Harry shrugged helplessly.
"Maybe you're just tired."
He knew better than to say it out loud, though. Hermione laid her wand against one plastic ring, and stared for a while. Two small circles of glittering diamond lay on the table, connected by a long black thread.
"It changed," said Hermione.
She sounded like she was trying to be enthusiastic, but had run out of energy.
"Now what?"
Harry felt a bit deflated by his research partner's lack of passion, but did his best not to show it. Maybe the same process would work in reverse to cheer her up?
"Now I test to see if it holds weight."
There was an A-frame Harry had rigged up to do an earlier experiment with diamond rods. You could make solid diamond objects easily, using transfiguration. They just wouldn't last. The earlier experiment had measured whether transfiguring a long diamond rod into a shorter diamond rod would allow it to lift a suspended, heavy weight as it contracted. I.e., could you transfigure against tension? Which you, in fact, could. Harry carefully looped one circle of glittering diamond over the thick metal hook at the top of the rig, then attached a thick metal hanger to the bottom ring, and then started attaching weights to the hanger. Harry had asked the Weasley twins to transfigure the apparatus for him, and the Weasley twins had given him an incredulous look, like they couldn't figure out what sort of prank he could possibly want that for, but they hadn't asked any questions. And their transfigurations, according to them, lasted for around 3 hours. So Harry and Hermione still had a while left.
100 kilograms,
Harry said about a minute later.
"I don't think a steel thread this thin would hold that. It should go up much higher, but that's all the weight I've got."
There was a further silence. Harry straightened up and went back to their table and sat down in his chair and ceremoniously made a check mark next to Bucky Tubes.
"There,"
Harry said.
"That one worked."
"But it's not really useful, Harry, is it?"
Hermione said from where she was sitting with her head resting in her hands.
"I mean, if we gave it to a scientist, they couldn't learn how to make lots of bucky tubes from studying ours."
"They might be able to learn something," Harry said. "Hermione, look at it. That little tiny thread holding up all that weight. We just made something that no muggle laboratory could make."
"But any other witch could make it,"
Hermione said. Her exhaustion was coming into her voice now.
"Harry, I don't think this is working out."
"You mean our relationship?"
Harry said.
"Great, let's break up."
That got a slight grin out of her.
"I mean our research."
"Oh, Hermione, how could you?"
"You're sweet when you're mean," she said. "But Harry, this is nuts. I'm 12. You're 11. It's silly to think we were going to discover anything that no one's ever figured out before."
"And you're really saying we should give up on unravelling the secrets of magic after trying for less than 1 month?"
Harry said, trying to put a note of challenge into his voice. honestly, he was feeling some of the same fatigue as Hermione. None of the good ideas ever worked. He'd made just one discovery worth mentioning, the Mendelian pattern, and he couldn't tell Hermione about it without breaking his promise to Draco.
No,
Hermione said. Her young face was looking very serious and adult.
I'm saying, right now, we should be studying all the magic that wizards already know, so we can do this sort of thing after we graduate from Hogwarts.
Harry said.
Hermione, I hate to put it this way, but imagine we decided to hold off on research until later, and the first thing we tried after we graduate was transfiguring an Alzheimer's cure. And it worked. We'd feel... I don't think the word stupid would adequately describe how we'd feel. What if there's something else like that, and it does work?
That's not fair, Harry,
Hermione said. Her voice was trembling like she was on the verge of breaking out crying.
You can't put that on people. It's not our job to do that sort of thing. We're kids.
For a moment, Harry wondered what would happen if someone told Hermione she had to fight an immortal Dark Lord. If she would turn into one of the whiny, self-pitying heroes that Harry could never stand reading about in his books.
Anyway,
Hermione said. Her voice shook.
I don't want to keep doing this. I don't believe children can do things that grown-ups can't. That's only in stories.
There was silence in the classroom. Hermione started to look a little scared, and Harry knew that his own expression had gotten colder. It might not have hurt so much if the same thought hadn't already come to Harry. That's while 30 might be old for a scientific revolutionary, and 20 about right, while there were people who got doctorates when they were 17 and 14 years old, heirs who'd been great kings or generals, there wasn't really anyone who'd made the history books at 11.
All right, Harry said. Figure out how to do something a grown-up can't. Is that your challenge?
I didn't mean it like that,
Hermione said, her voice coming out in a frightened whisper. With an effort, Harry wrenched his gaze away from Hermione.
I'm not angry at you,
Harry said. His voice was cold, despite his best efforts.
I'm angry at... I don't know. Everything. But I'm not willing to lose, Hermione. Losing isn't always the right thing to do. I'll figure out how to do something a grown wizard can't do, and then I'll get back to you. How's that?
There was more silence.
Okay,
said Hermione, her voice wavering a little. She pushed herself up out of her chair and went over to the door of the abandoned classroom they'd been working in. Her hand went onto the doorknob.
We're still friends, right? And if you can't figure out anything...
Her voice halted.
Then we'll study together,
Harry said. His voice was even colder now.
Bye for now, then,
Hermione said, and she quickly went out of the room and shut the door behind her. Sometimes Harry hated having a dark side, even when he was inside it. And the part of him that had thought exactly the same thing as Hermione, that no, children couldn't do what grown-ups couldn't, was saying all the things that Hermione had been too frightened to say, like,
"That's one hell of a difficult challenge you just grabbed for yourself,"
and,
"Boy, are you going to end up with egg on your face this time,"
and,
"At least this way you'll know you failed."
And the part of him that didn't enjoy losing replied, in a very cold voice,
"Fine. You can shut up and watch."
It was almost lunchtime, and Harry didn't care. He hadn't even bothered grabbing a snack bar from his pouch. His stomach could stand a little starving. The wizarding world was tiny. They didn't think like scientists. They didn't know science. They didn't question what they'd grown up with. They hadn't put protective shells on their time machines. They played Quidditch. All of magical Britain was smaller than a small muggle city. The greatest wizarding school only educated up to the age of 17. Silly wasn't challenging that at 11. Silly was assuming wizards knew what they were doing and had already exhausted all the low-hanging fruit a scientific polymath would see. Step one had been to make a list of every magical constraint Harry could remember. All the things you supposedly couldn't do. Step two. Mark the constraints that seemed to make the least sense from a scientific perspective. Step three. Prioritize constraints that a wizard would be unlikely to question if they didn't know science. Step four. Come up with avenues for attacking them. Hermione still felt a little shaky as she sat down next to Mandy at the Ravenclaw table. Hermione's lunch had two fruits, tomato slices and peeled tangerines, three vegetables, carrots and more carrots, one meat, fried Diracal drumsticks whose unhealthy coating she would carefully remove, and one little piece of chocolate cake that she would earn by eating the other parts. It hadn't been as bad as potions class. Sometimes she still had nightmares about that. But this time, she had made it happen, and she had felt like its target. Just for a moment, before the terrible cold darkness looked away and said it wasn't angry with her, because it hadn't wanted to scare her. And she still had that feeling like she'd missed something earlier. Something really important. But they hadn't violated any of the rules of transfiguration, had they? They hadn't made any liquids, any gases. They hadn't taken orders from the defense professor. The pill! That had been something to be eaten! Well, no, nobody would just eat a pill lying around. It hadn't worked, actually. They could have just finite incantatumed it if they had. But she would still have to tell Harry about that and make sure they didn't mention it in front of Professor McGonagall, in case they were never allowed to study Transfiguration again. Hermione was starting to get a really sick feeling in her stomach. She pushed back her plate from the table. She couldn't eat lunch like this. And she closed her eyes and began to mentally recite the rules of transfiguration.
I will never transfigure anything into liquid or gas. I will never transfigure anything that looks like food or anything else that goes inside a human body.
No, they really shouldn't have tried to transfigure the pill. Or they should have at least realized. She had been so caught up in Harry's brilliant idea that she hadn't thought. The sick feeling in Hermione's stomach was getting worse. There was a feeling in her mind of something hovering just on the edge of recognition. A perception about to invert itself. A young woman about to become a crone. A vase about to become two faces. And she went on, remembering the rules of transfiguration. Harry's knuckles had gone white on his wand by the time he stopped trying to transfigure the air in front of his wand into a paperclip. It wouldn't have been safe to transfigure the paperclip into gas, of course, but Harry didn't see any reason why it would be unsafe the other way around. It just wasn't supposed to be possible. But why not? Air was as real a substance as anything else. Well, maybe that limitation did make sense. air was disorganized, or the molecules constantly changing their relation to each other. Maybe you couldn't impose a new form on substance unless the substance was staying still long enough for you to master it, even though the atoms in solids were also constantly vibrating all the time. The more Harry failed, the colder he felt, the clearer everything seemed to become. All right, next on the list. You could only transfigure whole objects as wholes. You couldn't transfigure half a match into a needle. You had to transfigure the whole thing. Back when Harry had been trapped in that classroom by Draco, it had been the reason he couldn't just transfigure a thin cylindrical cross-section of the walls into sponge and punch out a chunk of stone large enough for him to fit through the hole. He would have needed to impose a new form on the whole wall, and maybe a whole section of Hogwarts, just in order to change that little cross-section. And that was ridiculous. Things were made of atoms. Lots of little tiny dots. There was no contiguity. There was no solidity. Just electromagnetic forces holding the little dots related to each other. Mandy Brocklehurst paused with her fork on her way to her mouth.
"Huh?"
she said to Sue Lee, sitting across from the now empty space beside her.
"What got into Hermione?"
Harry wanted to kill his eraser. He had been trying to change a single spot on the pink rectangle into steel, apart from the rest of the rubber, and the eraser wasn't cooperating. It had to be a conceptual limitation, not a real one. Had to be. Things were made of atoms, and every atom was a tiny separate thing. Atoms were held together by a quantum mist of shared electrons for covalent bonds, or sometimes just magnetism at close ranges for ionic bonds or van der Waals forces. If it came down to that, the protons and neutrons inside the nuclei were tiny separate things. The quarks inside the protons and neutrons were tiny separate things. There simply wasn't anything in reality, the world out there, that corresponded to people's conceit of solid objects. It was all just little dots. And free transfiguration was all in the mind to begin with, wasn't it? No words, no gestures, only the pure concept of form, kept strictly separate from substance, imposed on the substance, conceived of apart from its form. That, and the wand, and whatever, made you a wizard. The wizards couldn't transform parts of things, could only transform what their minds perceived as wholes, because they didn't know in their bones that it was all just atoms, deep down. Harry had focused on that knowledge as hard as he could. The true fact that the eraser was just a collection of atoms. Everything was just collections of atoms. And the atoms of the little patch he was trying to transfigure formed just as valid a collection as any other collection he cared to think about. And Harry still hadn't been able to change that single part of the eraser. The transfiguration wasn't going anywhere. This was ridiculous. Harry's knuckles were whitening on his wand again. He was sick of getting experimental results that didn't make sense. Maybe the fact that some part of his mind was still thinking in terms of objects was stopping the transfiguration from going through. He had thought of a collection of atoms that was an eraser. He had thought of a collection that was a little patch. Time to kick it up a notch. Harry pressed his wand harder against that tiny section of eraser and tried to see through the illusion that non-scientists thought was reality. The world of desks and chairs, air and erasers and people. When you walked through a park, the immersive world that surrounded you was something that existed inside your own brain as a pattern of neurons firing. The sensation of a bright blue sky wasn't something high above you. It was something in your visual cortex, and your visual cortex was in the back of your brain. All the sensations of that bright world were really happening in that quiet cave of bone you called your skull. The place where you lived and never ever left. If you really wanted to say hello to someone, to the actual person, you wouldn't shake their hand. You'd knock gently on their skull and say, "How you doing in there?" That was what people were. That was where they really lived. And the picture of the park that you thought you were walking through was something that was visualized inside your brain as it processed the signals sent down from your eyes and retina. It wasn't a lie, like the Buddhists thought. There wasn't something terribly mystical and unexpected behind the veil of Maya, or what lay beyond the illusion of the park was just the actual park. But it was all still illusion. Harry wasn't sitting inside the classroom. He wasn't looking at the eraser. Harry was inside Harry's skull. He was experiencing a processed picture his brain had decoded from the signals sent down by his retina. The real eraser was somewhere else, somewhere that wasn't the picture. And the real eraser wasn't like the picture Harry's brain had of it. The idea of the eraser as a solid object was something that existed only inside his own brain, inside the parietal cortex that processed his sense of shape and space. The real eraser was a collection of atoms held together by electromagnetic forces and shared covalent electrons, while nearby, air molecules bounced off each other and bounced off the eraser molecules. The real eraser was far away, and Harry, inside his skull, could never quite touch it, could only imagine ideas about it. But his wand had the power. It could change things out there, in reality. It was only Harry's own preconceptions that were limiting it. Somewhere beyond the veil of Maya, the truth behind Harry's concept of my wand was touching the collection of atoms that Harry's mind thought of as a patch on the eraser. And if that wand could change the collection of atoms that Harry considered the whole eraser, there was absolutely no reason why it couldn't change the other collection too. The transfiguration still wasn't going through. Harry's teeth clenched together, and he kicked it up another notch. The concept Harry's mind had of the eraser as a single object was obvious nonsense. It was a map that didn't, and couldn't, match the territory. Human beings modelled the world using stratified levels of organisation. They had separate thoughts about how countries worked, how people worked, how organs worked, how cells worked, how molecules worked, how quarks worked. When Harry's brain needed to think about the eraser, it would think about the rules that governed erasers, like erasers can get rid of pencil marks. Only if Harry's brain needed to predict what would happen on the lower chemical level, only then would Harry's brain start thinking, as though it were a separate fact, about rubber molecules. But that was all in the mind. Harry's mind might have separate beliefs about rules that governed erasers, but there was no separate law of physics that governed erasers. Harry's mind modelled reality using multiple levels of organisation, with different beliefs about each level.
but that was all in the map. The true territory wasn't like that. Reality itself had only a single level of organization. The quarks. It was a unified, low-level process obeying mathematically simple rules. Or at least that was what Harry had believed before he found out about magic. But the eraser wasn't magical. And even if the eraser had been magical, the idea that there could really exist a single solid eraser was impossible. Things like erasers couldn't be basic elements of reality. They were too big and complicated to be atoms. They had to be made of parts. You couldn't have things that were fundamentally complicated. The implicit belief that Harry's brain had in the eraser as a single object wasn't just wrong. It was a map territory confusion. The eraser only existed as a separate concept in Harry's multi-level model of the world, not as a separate element of single-level reality. The transfiguration still wasn't happening. Harry was breathing heavily. Failed transfiguration was almost as tiring as successful transfiguration, but damned if he'd give up now. All right, screw this 19th-century garbage. Reality wasn't atoms. It wasn't a set of tiny billiard balls bopping around. That was just another lie. The notion of atoms as little dots was just another convenient hallucination that people clung to because they didn't want to confront the inhumanly alien shape of the underlying reality. No wonder, then, that his attempts to transfigure based on that hadn't worked. If he wanted power, he had to abandon his humanity and force his thoughts to conform to the true math of quantum mechanics. There were no particles. There were just clouds of amplitude in a multi-particle configuration space. And what his brain fondly imagined to be an eraser was nothing except a gigantic factor in a wave function that happened to factorize. It didn't have a separate existence any more than there was a particular solid factor of 3 hidden inside the number 6. If his wand was capable of altering factors in an approximately factorizable wave function, then it should damn well be able to alter the slightly smaller factor that Harry's brain visualized as a patch of material on the eraser. Hermione tore through the hallways, shoes pounding hard on the stone, breath coming in pants, the shock of adrenaline still racing through her blood. Like a picture of a young woman turning into an old crone, like the cup becoming two faces. What had they been doing? What had they been doing? She came to the classroom and her fingers slipped on the doorknob at first, too sweaty. She grabbed harder and the door opened. In a single flash of perception, she saw Harry staring at a small pink rectangle on the table in front of him. As, a few paces away, the tiny black thread, almost invisible from this distance, supported all that weight.
Harry, get out of the classroom!
Pure shock crossed Harry's face, and he stood up so fast he almost fell over, stopping only to grab the small pink rectangle from the table, and he tore out of the door. She'd already stepped aside. Her wand was already in her hand, coming up, pointing at the thread.
Finite incantatum!
And Hermione slammed the door shut again, just as the gigantic crash of 100 kilograms of falling metal came from inside. She was panting, gasping for air. She'd run all the way here without stopping. She was soaked in sweat, and her legs and thighs burned like living flames. She couldn't have answered Harry's questions for all the galleons in the world. Hermione blinked and realized that she had started to fall, and Harry had caught her and was lowering her gently to sit on the floor.
Healthy?
She managed to whisper.
What?
said Harry, looking paler than she'd ever seen him.
Are you feeling healthy?
Harry started looking even more frightened as the question sank in.
I don't think I have any symptoms.
Hermione closed her eyes for a moment.
Catch,
she whispered.
Catch breath.
That took a while. Harry was still looking scared. That was good, too. Maybe it would teach him a lesson. Hermione reached into the pouch Harry had bought her, whispered,
"Water!"
through her parched throat, took out the bottle, and drank in great huge gulps. And then it was still a while before she could talk again.
"We broke the rules, Harry,"
she said in a hoarse voice.
"We broke the rules!"
"Aye,"
Harry swallowed.
"I still don't see how. I've been thinking, but
I asked if the Transfiguration was safe, and you answered me."
There was a pause.
"That's it?" Harry said.
She could have screamed.
"Harry, don't you get it?"
she said.
"It's made out of tiny fibers. What if it unraveled? Who knows what could go wrong? We didn't ask Professor McGonagall. Don't you see what we were doing? We were experimenting with transfiguration. We were experimenting with transfiguration."
There was another pause.
"Right," Harry said slowly. "That's probably one of those things they don't even bother telling you not to do because it's too obvious. Don't test brilliant new ideas for transfiguration by yourselves in an unused classroom without consulting any professors."
"You could have gotten us killed, Harry!"
Hermione knew it wasn't fair. She had made the mistake too, but she still felt angry at him. He always sounded so confident, and that had dragged her unthinkingly along in his wake.
"We could have spoiled Professor McGonagall's perfect record."
"Yes," said Harry. "Let's not tell her about this, shall we?"
"We have to stop,"
Hermione said.
"We have to stop, or we're going to get hurt. We're too young, Harry. We can't do this. Not yet."
A weak grin crossed Harry's face.
You're sort of wrong about that."
And he held out a small pink rectangle, a rubber eraser with a bright metal patch on it. Hermione stared at it, puzzled.
"Quantum mechanics wasn't enough," Harry said. "I had to go all the way down to timeless physics before it took. Had to see the wand as enforcing a relation between separate past and future realities, instead of changing anything over time. But I did it, Hermione. I saw past the illusion of objects, and I bet there's not a single other wizard in the world who could have. Even if some muggle-born knew about timeless formulations of quantum mechanics, it would just be a weird belief about strange, distant quantum stuff. They wouldn't see that it was reality, except that the world they knew was just a hallucination. I transfigured part of the eraser without changing the whole thing."
Hermione raised her wand again, pointed it at the eraser. For a moment, anger crossed Harry's face, but he didn't make any move to stop her.
"Finite incantatum,"
said Hermione.
"Check with Professor McGonagall before you try it again."
Harry nodded, though his face was still a bit tight.
"And we still have to stop,"
said Hermione.
"Why?" said Harry. "Don't you see what this means, Hermione? Wizards don't know everything. There's too few of them, even fewer who'd know any science. They haven't exhausted the low-hanging fruit.
It's not safe,
Hermione said.
If we can find out new things, it's even less safe. We're too young. We made one big mistake already. Next time, we could just die.
Then Hermione flinched. Harry looked away from her and started taking slow, deep breaths.
Please don't try to do it alone, Harry,
Hermione said, her voice trembling.
Please? Please don't make me have to decide whether to tell Professor Flitwick.
There was a long pause.
So, you want us to study?
Harry said. She could tell he was trying to keep the anger out of his voice.
Just study.
Hermione wasn't sure if she should say anything, but...
Like you studied, timeless physics, right?
Harry looked back at her.
That thing you did,
Hermione said, her voice tentative.
It wasn't because of our experiments, right? You could do it because you'd read lots of books.
Harry opened his mouth, and then he shut it again. There was a frustrated look on his face.
All right, Harry said. How about this? We study, and if I think of anything that seems really worth trying, we'll try it after I ask a professor.